Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Kevin Camps with the group Beyond Nuclear, who assesses the magnitude of Japan's multiple nuclear accidents and the consequences for human health. Ali Abdul-Latif Amida, professor of political science at the University of New England, who examines the calls for Western powers to militarily intervene in the rebellion seeking to overthrow the government of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, and Bill Fletcher, Jr., senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and a longtime labor activist, who discusses the labor movement's response to the GOP's multi-state attack on public sector unions' collective bargaining rights. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
President Barack Obama signed an executive order in early March to create a new system of indefinite detention for detainees held at the military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. The order, which establishes a new review system for terrorism detainees, comes 2 years after then-newly elected President Obama promised to close the Guantanamo Detention Center. The administration has faced strong resistance in Congress to transferring terrorism detainees to American maximum security prisons. ACLU Executive Director Anthony Romero blasted the order as a complete about-face on closing the military prison. Lawyer David Reams, who represents 20 detainees, says there is no real difference between the review system set up in the Obama executive order and the policy in place under the previous Bush administration. According to the Washington Post, the order applies to 48 of the remaining 172 detainees at Gitmo. These detainees, according to Justice Department lawyers, cannot be tried in a military commission or in U.S. courts because of problems in disclosing evidence. Under Obama's executive order, each detainee will receive an unclassified review of the reasons for their indefinite detention. Prisoners have the right to present evidence to contest the findings of the review. On the 52nd anniversary of the Tibetan revolt against Chinese rule, the Dalai Lama announced he will resign from his political role in leading the Tibet government in exile based in Dharamsala, India. For several years, the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibetan Buddhism, has expressed a desire to step aside from his political role and encourage a transition to democracy inside the Tibetan exile community. For decades, the Dalai Lama has been the international symbol of resistance to Chinese domination over Tibet, which Beijing took over after the 1949 Communist Revolution. To this day, the Dalai Lama's active role among Tibetan exiles in Asia has fueled conflict between China and India. In his statement, the Dalai Lama praised the power of nonviolence in the recent youth revolt in Arab countries, observing, "We must all hope these inspiring changes lead to genuine freedom, happiness, and prosperity." According to the Washington Post, the move by the Dalai Lama was resisted by the current government in exile. An election for a new Tibetan prime minister is set for March 20th. A growing number of large American cities have hired food czars to increase local access to affordable, healthy foods for low-income residents. San Francisco was the first city to appoint a food czar in 2002. More recently, other major cities such as New York, Boston, Los Angeles, and Baltimore have followed suit. Increasingly, poor people live in so-called food deserts, where many grocery stores have moved away while fast food joints and convenience stores have opened in large numbers. The result is a rising level of obesity in many urban neighborhoods. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 17 million American families went hungry in 2009. At the same time, 40% of the nation's adults and nearly 20% of children are considered obese. In Baltimore, food czar Holly Freistadt is seeking to boost urban agriculture, especially local greenhouses that grow winter vegetables, including carrots and kale. The city has identified 35 acres of city land that could be converted into new urban farms. But according to the Christian Science Monitor, anti-hunger activists are skeptical that local food projects can make a significant dent in chronic food insecurity among 50 million Americans caused by persistent urban and rural poverty. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
The disasters that have befallen Japan continue to multiply. Thousands are already confirmed dead, with the toll expected to exceed 10,000 from both the 9.0 magnitude earthquake and the tsunami it triggered, which struck the island nation on March 11th. Add to these already cataclysmic conditions, failures of cooling systems, hydrogen explosions, fires, and the possible breach of containment structures at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in the northern part of the country, where three reactors were operating at the time. The failures at the nuclear plant may result in the worst scenario imaginable, a meltdown, with a massive release of radiation. Hundreds of thousands of people have been evacuated from the area, and another 140,000 living in proximity to the plant being ordered to stay inside their homes, sealing them up as best they can to prevent radiation exposure. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Kevin Camps, a nuclear waste specialist with the group Beyond Nuclear, whose mission is to educate and activate the public on the connections between nuclear power and nuclear weapons. The group advocates for the abandonment of both to safeguard the planet's future. Camps talks about the effects of exposure to radiation on human health and why building more nuclear plants in the U.S. is not the solution to our energy needs or to address the dangers of global warming. The information in this interview reflects facts known about Japan's nuclear power accident on March 13th.
Well, it's fair to say this is an unprecedented nuclear emergency in history. Radioactive cesium is escaping at Fukushima, as is radioactive iodine. And radioactive iodine-131 attacks the human thyroid gland, and that's why there has already been widespread distribution of potassium iodide tablets to evacuees. The evacuees now number 350,000 people, which means that this is an evacuation as big as the evacuation that took place around Chernobyl 25 years ago. So it's a good thing that they're distributing potassium iodide. They did not do that at Chernobyl. There's been a thyroid pathology epidemic in Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia ever since Chernobyl happened because they didn't distribute these protective tablets. But one problem in Japan is that they, again, were downplaying the situation in the early hours. They only evacuated people out to 2 miles from the Fukushima nuclear power plant, and they told other people beyond that point just to stay indoors. Well, they should have evacuated those people in the beginning. Everybody should have been given potassium iodide tablets immediately. They were not, and so there were many hours where people were in their home as little as 3 kilometers away from this reactor in distress without potassium iodide tablets, breathing radioactivity in the air, radioactive gases, radioactive particles in fine dust form. If radioactive cesium and radioactive iodine are loose in the environment, that means that there has at least been fuel damage. But now we know that there is a partial meltdown because the authorities have admitted it. There are over 200 different radioactive isotopes in nuclear fuel, in high-level radioactive waste, and many of them are biologically hazardous. So any talk of benign radioactivity or less harmful radioactivity is very misleading. You name the radioactive isotope, it's going to have its own particular impact on the human body. Radioactive cesium seeks muscle tissue. Radioactive strontium seeks bone. Radioactive iodine seeks the thyroid. Plutonium, a microscopic speck in your lung, if inhaled, will initiate lung cancer. It may take a decade or two, but you will have lung cancer someday if you inhale plutonium. That, too, may be being released right now in Japan because the fuel has melted down. Everything in it is now airborne. It's being driven out of the reactor into the environment by steam and pressure and falling out downwind over vast territories at this point.
Hey, Kevin Camps, someone I respect a lot, James Hansen, says we need more nuclear power to offset fossil fuels to reduce the threat of climate change. These existing plants are mostly like 40 years old. What about a new generation of nukes with a different design?
Well, I'm sorry to have to say that I think James Hansen really needs to do his research on this subject. I know that he is a brilliant climatologist and very courageous in that regard, but his advocacy for Generation 4 atomic energy as some kind of solution to the climate crisis is just very misplaced. The reason I say that is that Generation 4 atomic reactors are decades off, most optimistically, because they are not, as you said, in existence yet. They are merely on paper. About a decade ago, the top leading candidate, Generation 4 atomic reactor, again, this is all theory, it's not reality yet, it was called a pebble bed modular reactor. And the best selling point for the industry on this reactor was, we're going to save a whole lot of money in the construction of these reactors because we're not going to build containment buildings because they're so inherently safe. You couldn't possibly melt one down. You don't need containment if you're not going to have a meltdown. That was what they said. September 11th happened. The major U.S. partner in the deal walked away. A South African firm was leading this effort. And Exelon Nuclear of Chicago walked away from the project because without a containment building, this reactor, even if it were true, which it's not, that it was inherently safe, would be wide open to terrorist attack. And just like with the Chernobyl reactor, the pebble bed modular reactor used a lot of graphite in its design. Graphite is flammable. So from a security perspective, it was wide open to attack and catastrophic radioactivity release. But even the safety issues with that reactor were very real. In Germany, a pebble bed modular reactor that was research and scale suffered a radiation release right about the same time as the Chernobyl disaster. So we've had accidents. We have the risk of attack. That was the lead candidate Generation 4 design. So the thing is, something that's that far off in the future anyway, not even perfected, actually risky, it can't help us with the climate crisis. As Hansen himself has said, we have a decade or two to turn this thing around in a very big way. We can't wait a generation for these new reactors to show up. And besides waiting that long, these new reactors are going to cost literally hundreds of billions of dollars just in research and development and then finally construction. So we could waste a whole lot of time and a whole lot of money and a whole lot of breath arguing about more atomic energy of a better form. But we could solve the problem in the meantime, if we chose to, with renewables, with efficiency, that do not have radiological risks whatsoever.
That was Kevin Camps of Beyond Nuclear. Contact the group at area code 301-270-2209 or visit their website at beyondnuclear.org. The protests and uprisings that have shaken autocratic governments and monarchies across the Middle East and North Africa took a deadly turn in Libya when Colonel Muammar Gaddafi, in power for 41 years, directed his military to suppress peaceful demonstrators against his regime. The violence used to silence the anti-Gaddafi protesters resulted in a full-scale armed rebellion with many of Gaddafi's army officers and soldiers defecting to the rebel side. But after an initial rout of government forces that put the rebel army within striking distance of Libya's capital, Tripoli, the insurgents have lost territory to Gaddafi troops and have been in retreat to the point where they may soon be forced to make a last stand in their eastern stronghold of Benghazi. For the most part, the U.S. and other nations have stood by and watched the conflict unfold, unwilling to impose the no-fly zone over Libya that the rebels' Transitional National Council has requested. While France has recognized the council as Libya's legitimate government, other nations have not followed. Despite the endorsement of a no-fly zone by the Arab League, the U.N. Security Council is divided on the issue. But current U.N. consideration of the measure and additional economic and political sanctions may come too late for the rebels. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Ali Abdullatif Amida, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of New England. Professor Amida, who was born in Libya and studies the history of anti-colonial resistance in North Africa, examines the calls for Western powers to militarily intervene in the conflict and provides a profile of Libya's opposition movement.
Your listeners should know that the vast majority of the Libyan people will be against any military intervention. This has to do with their own history in the 20th century, where Libyan society endured one of the most brutal colonization, and 500,000 Libyans perished during that time between 1911 and 1943 because of the nature of Italian colonialism, especially under the fascists, who really were very brutal, and thousands and thousands of Libyans died there. So the first thing is we have to be aware of the fact most Libyans will not like military intervention. However, the International Libyan Council and many, many Libyans who are leading this uprising, and many of us, either American citizens or people living abroad, I think in agreement with them, there are other things could be done. The no-fly zone is one thing. Arming and giving aid and medicine to the liberated regions is very crucial. but also raining on some Arab governments like Algeria and Syria and Yemen, and some West African countries like Chad, Niger, Mali, who are sending supporters and mercenaries to fight for Gaddafi there as well.
Professor Amida, if the international community does not enforce a no-fly zone quite soon, are the rebel forces in danger of being routed here and driven into the desert? Or what are your concerns about the next few days or weeks in this conflict?
We know that the regime will do anything to stay in power. This is the mentality and the psyche of Gaddafi's regime and his circle of followers in Tripoli. I could see a disaster. I could see massacre using the air force and tanks to pound the eastern region and the other towns that rebelled against him. However, I think the fact that many officers and many soldiers defected, many diplomats defected from the regime and joined the uprising, tells me that this is not inevitable. If aid and arms were given to undiplomatic recognition and pressure, keeping the pressure, the fact that now the regime lost legitimacy inside Libya, that the Arab League also took the legitimacy from the regime, the fact that there is worldwide condemnation, and also our own Obama administration should, in coordination with the Arab League, to have a legal mechanism to give aid, give arms, and also impose no-fly zone and isolate the regime.
The Libyan opposition groups are comprised of many factions, I'm sure. But I wondered if you would give us your best guess as to what a new government of opposition groups would possibly look like if they were to defeat Gaddafi and take power in the nation of Libya.
Well, right now we have a coalition. The leaders are the foot soldiers who really are daring and they throw their lives, are the youth, middle-class youth who are educated. And the council now is led by 30 members who represent professionals, intellectuals, judges. Even the religious figures are not really extremists, and they have a vision and agreement so far on democratic, pluralistic Libya that has a constitution, that has recognition of the international law and organization, and awareness that Libya, one of the richest in Africa and has one of the highest literacy rates in Africa, needs a long, long way to go to rebuild the country. And many of the leaders, which is very, very interesting, Scott, there are people who were either educated or they were working for the regime. Some of them were ministers in Gaddafi's regime. They were the most respected and reformist among his elite. And they are the ones who are looked at favorably by most people in Libya. The irony of what's going on in Libya, many Libyans, even though they didn't like the regime, they said maybe we could reform it peacefully without losing lives, without destroying the country. But because they were pushed in a corner, they reached a dead end, and they realized that you cannot reform a regime like this because we tried and we failed. Now it's time for us to try to topple the regime and rebuild a new system.
That was Ali Abdullatif Amida, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science at the University of New England. He is the author of The Making of Modern Libya, State Formation, Colonization, and Resistance. After weeks of massive and sustained pro-labor demonstrations against Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker's legislation to strip public employee unions of most of their collective bargaining rights, Walker prevailed and signed the bill into law on March 11th. Passage of the bill came despite the absence of 14 Democratic senators from the state in a move to deny the Republican majority a quorum. The GOP revised Walker's budget repair bill, carving out the section designed to weaken unions, thus overcoming the need for the Democrats to be present for a quorum. Democrats have filed a complaint with the state capitol's district attorney, charging the maneuvers Republicans employed to pass the bill violated the state's open meetings law. Anti-Walker activists are also getting petition signatures to recall 8 Republican state senators who voted for the union-busting bill. If the Democrats can win 3 additional seats in the state Senate, they will take control of that branch of the legislature. On April 5th, election for a state Supreme Court seat, currently held by a Republican, is another focus of pro-union forces. The day after Walker signed his anti-union bill, an estimated 100,000 people protested at the state capitol and gave the returning 14 Democratic lawmakers who had earlier fled the state a hero's welcome. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Fletcher, Jr., a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and former vice president for international trade union development programs with the George Meany Center of the AFL-CIO. He discusses the labor movement's response to the Republican Party's multi-state attack against public sector unions' collective bargaining rights.
The attack that's going on working people right now, I call it the final offensive. That we've been going through a 35-year war against working people. The living standard of working people has been dropping since roughly 1975. And greater and greater amounts of wealth are being accumulated by smaller and smaller percentages of the population. And then on top of that, or as part of that, unions have been under assault actively since the early 1980s. It's been an ongoing, protracted fight that many people judged based on the specific incidents. There was PATCO, and there was this and that, as opposed to understanding that the effort, the objective of the hardline Republican right is to eliminate unions. So what we're seeing right now is an attempt, using the pretext of budgetary problems, to get rid of public sector unions. And people should be very clear, the U.S. is not broke. The states are not broke. There's a fiscal crisis that's largely the result of irrational tax cuts that have taken place that have benefited the rich. And so when they're in the midst of these financial crises, what's happening is that the unions become the scapegoats, and the public sector unions in particular. And so we're witnessing an attempt to get rid of unions altogether.
Bill Fletcher, we've seen an outpouring of solidarity protests and recall petition drives in states like Wisconsin, also similar developments in Ohio, Indiana, Tennessee, Idaho, and elsewhere. The involvement by just grassroots people is unlike almost anything we've seen from the labor movement in many decades, and this seems to be coming up from the bottom, not from the top down. What is it that we're witnessing that seems so unique?
Well, what we're witnessing, and I agree with you, is in one part, and this may sound sort of strange for many of your listeners, is the contagion from the Arab revolt. That one of the things that has happened, and this is actually something that many journalists have been finding and talking to demonstrators in Wisconsin and other places, is that they actually were very inspired by what they've been seeing in the Arab world, where people under far worse conditions have stood up in massive numbers and taken on tyrannical regimes. So part of what happened was, in Wisconsin, it wasn't simply that people were tired of being stepped on, because Lord knows we've been stepped on for a long time, but people saw around the world that other people have been fighting back successfully. And so that becomes another contagion within the United States. And you're absolutely right. It is incredibly exciting to witness what's unfolding before our eyes. The challenge will now be, particularly after the Republican coup in Wisconsin last week, of moving quickly to separate the union destruction provisions from the rest of the budget, the challenge will now be, what next? How to continue the struggle? And part of that is going to have to be electoral, as you mentioned, recalls, as well as what I hope will be the identification of good progressive candidates who represent working people to run. But the other thing we're going to have to do is we're going to have to stay in the streets and make it clear that it isn't business as usual.
Bill, from your perspective, how can the labor movement take advantage of this once-in-a-generation moment when so many working families are ready to take a stand with substantial public support? A surprise to many, these polls have shown that overwhelmingly people do not want to see the government take away union rights from public employees, unions, or anybody else.
I think that there's several things that have to happen. One is that the unions themselves have to reformulate their mission. And their mission needs to be a mission of social justice. This is one of the key issues that we raise in our book, Solidarity Divided. But in addition to that, they've got to take on the question of revenue, that is, of taxes. The reality is that governments aren't funded based on magic or good wishes. There's money. The question is, where does the money come from? And if you want government to serve the population, it needs to be funded. So part of what the unions, to a great extent, have avoided for years is really taking on the question of, where do we get the money from? And when you deal with the reality of the polarization of wealth that's been taking place over the last 30, 35 years, we understand that we've got to go to those people who've been robbing us for these years, and we need to get that back. We also need, and again, many unions don't want to touch this, we need to take on the question of the wars. Afghanistan and Iraq have been breaking the bank, and even leaving aside the human costs of these wars, the fiscal costs are prohibitive. The unions really need to take that on. The other thing that they need to take on is that they need to win the battle around the issue of public service and public space. The unions have got to be understood to be the defenders, the guardians of the public space. And the people need to see them as those guardians. It means that the unions have to rethink their mission and see their mission is not simply protecting the rights and benefits of those who happen to be members of unions, but they have to really be advocates for economic justice.
That was Bill Fletcher, Jr., a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and a longtime labor activist. He is co-author of Solidarity Divided: The Crisis in Organized Labor and a New Path Towards Social Justice. Read Fletcher's articles online at blackcommentator.com, where he serves on the website's editorial board. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Vanzari.